Hey everyone, welcome to the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. Now momentarily, I'll be joined by my co-host, Mike Knapp, to talk about an exciting weekend of racing at Bristol Motor Speedway. Denny Hamlin is the hottest driver in NASCAR over the past month and a half, but it might be Matt Benedetto who has the best story. We go in-depth on Matty D's run at Bristol, as well as a potential landing spot for him in 2020. The Xfinity race was a good one over the weekend, but what's going on with Justin Allgaier and why can't the 7 team seal the deal? Both Neff and I think he could be a sleeper going into the playoffs and potentially make it to Homestead. Obviously, there was a lot of off-track news over the past week, including David Ragan announcing his retirement from full-time competition in NASCAR. We'll dive into his statistics and discuss why he and other drivers are retiring at such an early age. Then obviously, the biggest news of the week was Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s plane crash on the runway in Bristol. We'll give our feelings on that, but most importantly are happy and thankful that the Earnhardt family is healthy and doing well. But before we get started, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast, as those ratings help us out tremendously. Now let's talk Bristol with Neff. All right, Neff, I feel like we got a lot to talk about this week. Yes. But let's start with Bristol first. I thought, and I think you think, you know, you're in agreement with me, really good weekend of racing. The truck race was, you know, a bit of a show. The Xfinity Series race was really good, and the Cup Series race was arguably better. So, I guess I'll start with the Cup Series. Denny Hamlin gets his fourth win of the year, after, you know, coming off a winless season last year. But I feel like the real story of this race was the driver that finished second, that being Matt DiBenedetto, Neff, because he led 93 laps, which is the most laps he's ever led in a single race, most laps Levine Family Racing has ever led in a single race. And, you know, he did this the same week that he was announced that he's not coming back for that team next year. So we'll get to that in a minute. But, you know, DiBenedetto's always ran well at Bristol, finished sixth there a few years ago with BK Racing. What's your take on his race?
Sixth with BK. Just let that wash over you for a minute. Yeah, I mean, it was, you heard the thing that struck me the most was, and I consider Matty D a friend. The thing that struck me most was the crowd roar as Denny Hamlin is in victory lane and Matty D comes up on the big screen, and the crowd went bananas. It truly was crushing that he couldn't hang on. I hate that it was something where making contact with somebody else changed the race and ended up costing it to him. There were just so many factors at play in this deal. Denny was legitimately bummed about beating him. And, I mean, I know it's partly because he's friends with Matt, but it's also Mike Wheeler, the crew chief, mm-hmm. because he was Denny's crew chief. Denny famously made that comment that Mike Wheeler is the last crew chief I will ever have. And then, for all intents and purposes, cost him his job because he didn't win last year. And so Wheeler goes over to the 95, teams up with Matty D, and they've been lighting it up, and it just... I mean, it would have been the greatest Cinderella story ever. It was still a fantastic story, but it would have been even better had he won that thing and that put him in the... Can you imagine him being in the playoffs, racing without a job? I mean, that's the stuff that stories are made of, that, you know, movies are made of. And I give him complete credit because the race showcased his talent. All they talked about once he had the lead was how's he going to handle traffic, and he handled it like he had led 100 races in his career. I mean, he knifed through traffic, never put a wheel wrong. He got on a couple guys in odd spots, but that's going to happen to anybody. But he didn't put himself in jeopardy when he did. And I thought he drove the race perfectly. And unfortunately, the contact with Newman screwed up that left front corner just enough, which. Let's go down that road, shall we? That arrow at Bristol was so important that ultimately cost him the race. I hate that we're still at that point with the sport. But all in all, I mean, I'm with you. Amazing weekend at Bristol. The stands had way more people than they have for 4 or 5 years. I loved hearing that the campgrounds were sold out. I'm not sure that I buy it. I never saw any video of the campgrounds. And knowing how empty they've been the last couple, 3 years, I would venture to guess that maybe they made the spots bigger, so they sold out. But it still was a huge comeback for Bristol. And I don't know how much of that was because of the truck race, because I thought the truck race was garbage. But I was lambasted by numerous people on social media this weekend because they thought it was fantastic that you had to wreck people to pass them. So apparently that's what the majority want, and that may be why we had a bigger crowd on Saturday night. But all in all, thumbs up. I thought Denny Hamlin did an amazing job coming from the back, 17 times or something? They had so many things go wrong. But he did the same thing. I mean, look at his car. That thing was about as pristine as you're going to get for a Bristol race, having to come from the back legitimately three times.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely want to talk more about Matt, but, you know, I was in Bristol, obviously, and you could just feel like, I don't want to know if it's momentum, but, you know, just being there around, because I never do this when I'm covering a race, but on Saturday before the race, I had friends in town. I was staying with a friend in town. So I kind of roamed the midway, even though it's not really a midway at Bristol because it's so small. But there's a ton of fans, a lot of activities going on. And yeah, compared to last year, I would say there's a lot more people there, which is obviously a good thing. Especially after, you know, the spring race, which obviously the night race is always more popular. It's more of a I guess you could call it not crown jewel, but marquee event. And you know, in the spring, you could see that there was like nobody there, like literally the corners were bare. I definitely think that there's, you know, a good turnout, and I would say north of 100,000 if I had to guess. But going back to De Benedetto, man, I'll tie the crowd back into this. Like you said, you know, I watched the final 15 laps or so outside when Hamlin was starting to really catch him after De Benedetto had made that contact with Newman. And once Hamlin got to him, you kind of knew he was going to make short work of him. They touched one time. They hit each other. That obviously didn't matter. If anything, it might have hurt De Benedetto's car even a little bit more. But you could hear feel like a collective groan from the audience, from the crowd, because they wanted Matt D to win. He's so relatable to the everyday guy. Like you said, he's worked his ass off from starting, you know, the motorsports group back in the day and starting parking Xfinity cars and then Cup cars and just working his way up, getting that sixth place run at BK, spending 2 years at Go Fast and elevating that program. And then, you know, he's elevated Levine Family Racing to a whole new level this year. So it would have been a sight if he would have won. And it was cool after the race, as soon as Hamlin got out of the car, to be like, I am so sorry to Matt DiBenedetto and Mike Wheeler. You know, you don't really see that from a winner, a guy that had just won the race, and he should be feeling all this great emotion, which I'm sure he was, but then also just that he felt bad to beat a competitor who, you know, obviously runs the same manufacturer as him. But man, that was just, in my opinion, that was a classic Bristol race, just a classic short track race, a lot of action. Like you said, Hamlin came from the back like three times, was two laps down at one point for having a loose wheel. Just a great, great short track race.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's what I look for out of Bristol. I know it wasn't one lane at the bottom and you have to bump and run to get past people, which seems to be what the masses are calling for. But I loved the compound at the bottom was useful, but you had guys go to the top very early. Hamlin and Kurt Busch both went up to the top pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And so that incentivized people to get up there, and they got that top working early. But and you've seen it before when Joey Logano went up there. He runs that unique kind of diamond pattern coming off the corner. And Matt was using it some, Denny used it a little bit. And it just afforded people like five or six different ways to attack the track. And I love seeing that. Because it's almost dirt-like. The guys figure out what line works best for their car. And we saw guys that were good early, guys that were good late, some guys were good the whole race. I mean, it's what I want out of Bristol. It wasn't 21 cautions, which some people want that. But, man, as far as racing went, I don't think you could beat it.
Yeah, it was just entertaining. I thought Kevin Harvick really mastered the diamond, and he's always kind of ran it at Bristol, but I thought he had one of the fastest cars and was, I don't know if he was leading, but he was top five when he had the clutch go wrong or bad during the pit stop after stage two, which ultimately resulted in a last place finish, so he had nothing to show for it. But yeah, going back to the battle for the win, it was just, it was just a great race. That's what you want. And, you know, they were, at the end, the best cars. I think Hamlin, he won, but I think he had probably the best car all night. Just the way he was able to work through traffic. And a lot of guys throughout the weekend, like on Thursday, Friday, Xfinity on Thursday, truck on Thursday, and then Cup on Friday, they were hesitant to use the top. And you asked, like, Chase Elliott during the breakouts on Friday. He's like, I don't think we'll get up there. He said he wouldn't be the first one to get up there. A lot of people didn't think, you know, it was going to be the old Bristol back around the bottom. But that was far from the truth. So whether they were trying to hide it or they knew it was going to happen or just they were surprised like we were. Just a good race, multiple grooves. That's what we want. Not much tire fall off, which, you know, that'd be the next step, softer tire, because Kyle Busch after the race is like, these tires are like bricks. So I feel like that's the next step. Then we'll have really, really good racing.
Yeah, and we talked about that last week, that unfortunately I think Goodyear was put in a spot because they knew they were going to have so much more downforce this year that they did not want to see a repeat of the Indianapolis disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have erred on the side of hard tires to make sure that they can handle this downforce, and they're going to take the season's data and you know, kind of regurgitate through it. And I think next year you'll have tires that fall off more for these races but can handle the downforce. But back to Hamlin's apology, the only other time I remember that, and it wasn't so much a apology because he cared, but it was, I think he was trying to get out of the track alive, was when Harvick moved Junior at Martinsville to win. And Harvick got out of the car and apologized for beating Junior, but I think that was more self-serving because he was afraid he was going to get killed trying to leave the track. So he apologized for it. But yeah, it's rare. And I love that Denny pointed out post-race that he had, you know, people may have forgotten that there was a time at Phoenix last year, I think it was, that De Benedetto wasn't going to make the race at Phoenix. And Hamlin got on board and got a bunch of people motivated and raised enough money to sponsor their car for the race. And it ultimately led to like a 6-race deal with a poker website.
Right.
So Hamlin has definitely had a bigger interest in De Benedetto than most have. And I think that's why it truly struck him that he was bummed that he had to pass him to take the win. But as he said, he gets paid to win races, not to be a nice guy.
And he kind of elaborated that on that, too, during the press conference, saying how when he raced late models, like after his last race in late models, he thought that was it. But then I can't remember the full story, but someone came through with money and, you know, that advanced him to the next step. And then he got to Cup really fast in 2006. So, yeah, I mean, I think he sees true talent. We see true talent. We know Matty D's, you know, hell of a driver. Just hasn't had that right opportunity yet until this year. And even that, you know, they're working still working on a budget. It's nothing like, you know, what Furniture Row, and we've mentioned this in the past, what Furniture Row is getting from Gibbs, because in order to get that, you know, that alliance and that equipment, you need to spend money. So Bob Levine's been, you know, straight up pretty brutally honest when he mentions how he doesn't have the money that Barney Visser does. But I think with that lack of equipment, Matty D makes up in the seat. But Neff, that brings me to my next point, I guess, because this did come 2 days after he announced that he wasn't going to be back in the car for next year. There's an opening of Front Row Motorsports now, and we'll get into that in a little bit, because David Reagan's obviously retiring at the end of the year. But if you were De Benedetto, wouldn't want to go to that car, right? Because we've seen that's
a step back.
That's like, I mean, they're running worse than Go Fast this year, and that's where Matty D was last year. So you got to weigh your options. I think the best option would be maybe to go to the Xfinity Series, and I say that because you're going to probably get a top ride because you're going to bring a little bit of sponsorship because people are now attracted to you. And then also there's just not many Cup rides at the top rides open this year or this last season.
And that's where we're at. It's not so much Cup rides. It's Cup rides that they're going to give to you.
Right.
Because, I mean, let's be honest. I was watching the race last night on DVR again and thinking about that. And I'm like, who are the big teams? You got Hendrick. Chase Elliott's not going anywhere. William Byron's not going anywhere. Bowman.
They don't have sponsorship for next year, so I mean, that you never know.
See, you know, see, I know Bowman's got a win this year, but Matty D's run better than Bowman has. So if you put him in that car, I got no problem there. The other one's a 48. I mean, I know he says he wants to keep racing. Everybody says he wants to keep racing, contract extensions, all that kind of stuff. They are running like a bag of hammers right now. And I don't picture it happening, but it could. And that would be the one car that I could see him possibly land in if they don't boot Bowman, which, again, you said, Bowman doesn't have a sponsor. Matty D's going to bring something. I think he may, if they knew he was going to that car, I think you might be able to sell that even more. And, I mean, that could be a story. So, Hendrick, there's your option. He could easily, not easily, but could decently fall into 88 and outside crazy world, maybe end up in a 48. You go to Ganassi. Kurt says he wants to keep racing a couple more years. I think he does. So there's no place at Ganassi. You got Penske. Last I checked, we're not going to kill the cash cow. Yeah. So you're not kicking Menard out of the 21. Blaney is a superstar in the making in a sport, and your other two are recent champions. I say recent on Brad. 7 years is a little outside of recent, but recent enough, and he's still contending for championship.
Right.
So there's nobody at Penske that's going out. So you got Gibbs. Obviously, it ain't working at Gibbs because that's where he just lost his job from.
I mean,
RCR?
Well, you're
not firing the grandkids, and Hemric ain't just got in there, so they ain't taking him out. So, I mean, he doesn't want to go to Roush. I understand Roush is getting better. But right now, I look at Roush on par or slightly behind Levine. So I don't know that there's, unless you're going to knock out Bowman, there's a spot at a championship contending ride that he could get into.
Well, you're missing Stuart Haas Racing, but Harvick's going to be coming back. Suarez is coming back. He's got a sponsorship.
I forget about that. If Harvick goes to the booth, I can see him going to four.
Right, but that...
If Boyer does come back, which I honestly don't think he is, I'm pretty sure Cole Custer is going to be in the 14.
But then you...
I don't think you're going to... Cole Custer wait another year so that Benedetto could get in.
I mean, I agree with you, and obviously, Cole Custer's dad is a big role in the company at Haas. So that's, he's get sponsorship from Haas. He's always going to get sponsorship a little bit, at least from Haas, even if he is attracted or other sponsors are attracted to him, which this year has been a case. He's got more outside sponsorship. He's also won a lot more this year. So, then there's rumors that going around right now the biggest news rumor is the 32 of GoFast is looking to purchase some Stuart Haas Racing equipment and form sort of an alliance like De Benedetto and the 95 have this year with Gibbs. And that driver could be Corey LaJoy, or it could be Cole Custer. But going back to De Benedetto, man, I really think the best option is go to Xfinity for a year because you don't want to do what you've already done and just ride around and, kind of elevate a program, but finish 25th every week.
The only other one that I thought of out of that, and it would almost be kind of an olive branch from Toyota, would be put him in a Kyle Busch truck. Yeah. I know it's two steps down, but you put him in a Kyle Busch truck, he could win
half the
a
year.
Dozen races.
Yeah, he could win half the year.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Xfinity was better suited for him, and plus more exposure, more money. It's a tough deal because we obviously see that he's one of the best drivers in NASCAR. I think maybe that's a bit of a bold statement, but he could be.
He's top 10.
Yeah.
I don't think saying he's a top 10 driver
on raw talent. You could throw guys in there, honestly, too, like Ross Chastain. They just don't have the funding to support their talent, which sucks. It really does, and I'm sure it's got to be a killer for him because he knows, and he said it right after the race. He said, whatever team picks me up for next year, I hope a team picks me up for next year, and they'll be happy they do because I'm going to win races. Now, that's a lot of confidence from De Benedetto, which obviously should be growing because he's got three top fives and five top tens in the past 9 races. I don't know, man. I just feel like the best fit just for 1 year is to go to Xfinity because – Yes, we've seen a lot of drivers that haven't been able to come back up, like Justin Allgaier, for instance, right? He comes up for 2 years in Cup full-time, and they're terrible, running with a bad team, goes back down, and yes, he's been stuck there, but he's happy there at Junior Motorsports.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about running with a bad team, but ran better for that team than Clint Bowyer did.
Yeah, that's true. So
he had better finishes for H. Scott than Clint Bowyer ever did.
Right, so I don't know. I just feel like the best option for him for a year, it'd just be a brief stint, because then you come 2021 and there's more openings and people know that you can drive. So I feel like, and you could win a championship. You could realistically win a championship, win
six. Well, and that was why I was going with the Kyle Busch truck.
Yeah.
I think that would be a really, and there's no such thing as an easy championship. I mean, you know, we've seen how the luck Johnny Sauter's had this year in trucks. That could happen to Matt. But I feel like he could go out there in a Kyle Busch truck and literally win 10 to 12 races and walk away with the championship. And that further strengthens his resume. But I'm with you. I mean, Xfinity is obviously the better position, but who's he going to get to drive with?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know which car is going to come available in that.
Well,
and
the 20...
Again, it would be one of these things, does he line up and get in the double zero if Custer's moving up somewhere? That could be... And that could align him so that, assuming Harvick keeps running next year and then goes to the booth.
Yeah.
Because that's the other one I'm still curious about. I know Harvick has said he wants to run. I think Harvick's got 5 to 7 years still left in him, which may be optimistic. But right now is the time for Harvick to move because of DW's opening. If they put somebody in that spot, it's going to be 2 or 3 years before they move somebody else in there. So it's a matter of, does he want it now or does he want to wait 2 or 3 years? Because it's not like he can wait 1 year and then go into booth, because there's not going to be any openings.
Yeah. The only other option, and this is getting way off track, but is if one day Mike Joy retires, and we've seen that Harvick can do the play-by-play, and he's pretty good at it, in my opinion. And it'd be a non-traditional booth where you have actually a driver doing a play-by-play. But
that would be...
That
I would be intrigued that, by that.
Yeah,
that would
give...
Yes, Ned Jarrett did the pits, but he still never did play-by-play in the booth.
Yeah.
And that would be a unique transition. But yeah. I could absolutely see Harvick doing it.
And Harvick's a professional in the booth, as we've seen. He's done, you know, all the driver-only broadcasts for the Xfinity Series the past 3 years, and he's done play-by-play for all of them, and I think he's been really, really good at all of them. I've, you know, highly touted his horn of saying that he should be a play-by-play analyst, and I know that's untraditional and unconditional, I guess you could even say, for a driver or any sport athlete to go back to their sport and be a play-by-play analyst. But... hey, why not be different? Because you see, like, NBC, they have these, not driver only, but, like, on NASCAR America last night, I was watching on Monday, and they had, who was it? Kyle Petty, Dale Jarrett, and Steve Letarte just shooting the shit about whatever and anything. So, I know it's a TV show compared to an actual race, but you never know. And also, that would give him a few more years in the seat, where, like you said, he's still competitive. And then maybe Matty D gets that ride in a few years. But, getting a little off track here, but... yeah, the story of that of Bristol was Matty D. The reaction that he got on pit road. I don't know what was being shown at home or on NBC, but Colossus Bristol has their, you know, they have the big TV Colossus, really cool, and they get their own pit reporters for that. So Hannah Newhouse was interviewing him, or, you know, getting ready to interview him, and once he's on the TV screen, the, you know, big Colossus crowd erupts. Like,
yeah, and it was right when Hamlin was literally, like, had just gotten out of the car in victory lane, and they were getting ready to do the interview with him. And he basically paused it and let that cheer die down before he started the interview, to kind of almost let Matty D have his moment.
Yeah, and I, you know, obviously they're not playing favorites, but I got to be honest, I got chills that, because I've been to a ton of sporting events, but I don't think I've never been in a situation where I heard so many fans just cheer on one guy. Yes, maybe Dale Jr.
Yeah.
When he wins it, you know, I saw him win at Pocono a few times. I've seen him win a few other races. But, man, just people can relate to Matty D. And that, I think that's the best part about this. And, you know, he was popular coming up the ranks. He's done a lot of cool stuff. He came out as the Italian Stallion in driver intros, which is cool. And, it, you know, it was a good model for the week that he had. And I just hope he keeps his head up, because yes, this is a tough time for him, and I know he's going through a lot. You know, obviously he talked about it a lot this past weekend. But he's a future winner in the Cup Series, and I don't know. I feel like I'm pretty high on Matty D right now.
Yeah, me too. And I mean, there's been a few of those moments. I think when Chastain won in the 42, the crowd went pretty bananas. I know when Bubba Wallace won.
Yeah.
Both at Martinsville and at Eldora, the place really went crazy. Of instances where I've been there and heard it. I mean, Keselowski winning at Talladega was a pretty big one. And it was partly Keselowski winning it and partly the circumstances where, you know, Stewart had the win taken away from him in the Xfinity race.
Right.
Or was a Regan Smith. I know one of those two had the win taken away because they moved instead of causing a big wreck. And so Keselowski was like, hey, I can't move or they'll take it away. So he held his line and Carl Edwards ends up in a fence.
But,
so there was a little bit of extenuating circumstances on that. But yeah, it's rare to just have a deafening roar over somebody winning or doing something outside of Dale Jr.
Yeah, and the differences between most of that is that they all won the race. He finished second. So,
yeah.
You know, he's won the hearts of the crowd, the fans, the diehard fans, and the casual fans, I believe, because of the way he's won about his whole career. And that's yeah, cool to see because we don't see a lot of that anymore. He's done it the right way, coming up the ranks. And I truly think good things are in the future for Matty D. But Neff, moving along, I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about Hamlin because this guy's on a roll. Last year, zero wins, but winless for the first time in his career. Now Neff, as we said last week, he was on a streak of five straight top fives. Well, now that's six and extending his career long. So right now he's, you know, Harvick's been pretty fast too recently. Obviously he finished last the other night, but he was running top five when that happened, when the clutch went wrong. So I don't know. I feel like Hamlin right now is the hottest driver in the sport. And dare I say, maybe the championship favorite.
I'm hesitant to throw that moniker on him just because of history.
Right.
But it was interesting, again, post-race stuff, listen to him talk, and just the mental approach and how he realizes he's a different driver now. And as he said, he's lost 13 of these, and he's been through that. And 2010, I mean, that could have made him or broke him. And initially, I think it broke him, but now I feel like it made him. And I feel like he's got a more level head than he's ever had before. And part of it may just be old age and experience. Part of it may be, and this is going to sound almost mean, but partly because they constantly shoot themselves in the foot. And he's always seeming to have to rebound and come from the back to get the finishes he's been getting. And, yeah, it's not, you know, ideal that they have to do that a lot. But I think that has really steeled him as a driver and made him better and more pragmatic about his approach to the sport. So I still don't want to flag him as a favorite just because of the history. But as drivers go right now, they're as hot as anybody in the sport.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I feel like he's arguably the championship favorite is because he's getting hot at the right time, obviously. And then also, you look at the playoff points, and he's tied with Truex for second. But this is the most, by far, he's ever going to have going into the new, you know, I guess the current playoff format.
Yeah, he even talked about that.
Yeah.
That it's going to change his approach. Or his mental approach, anyway, knowing that he's got a cushion. And he said he's never really had a cushion before. So we'll see if that works out. But at least he's got a different mentality going into this one.
And I'm looking at stats right now, and his average finish this year is ninth, 9.0. And his previous best was in 2017, where it was 11.6. So, I mean, that's pretty good for being your 14th year of full-time competition. Yeah, they're just in the zone. I think Chris Gabehart kind of goes under the radar because he didn't – I mean, he had success at Xfinity for sure, Didn't last year with Brandon Jones, but you know they bring him up to Cup, and man, it's like strapped a rocket under his ass or something, because they're the hottest team in NASCAR, and I think he's done a lot for Hamlin. Like you said, 2010 might have made or broke Hamlin. I think last year also might have broke Hamlin, and you know, he mentioned he was pretty. This was one of the most honest new press, most, you know, after the post race press conference that I've ever seen with a driver on Saturday night, and it was with Hamlin, and he was just talking about anything and everything, and how he's matured this year, and he knew this year he had to mature on a personal and professional level, and he's done just that. You see him, I feel like, you know, I don't want to judge how someone spends time with their family, but it looks like on social media, posts more about his family now, and it just seems like everything's going right for this guy, and that's good to see, because last year was a disaster.
Yeah, and I was kind of curious about that, and I don't dig into these guys' personal lives. I think the whole TMZ approach to this stuff gets blown out of proportion sometimes. But he's acknowledged post-race about personal changes he had made to himself and making himself a better person. And I don't know the details of, you know, what he had to deal with or what he has had in his personal life, but it truly sounds like he's made changes in his personal life that are spilling over into his racing life. And again, I think he's got a different mindset and a different approach than he's ever had before. So it may have taken him 13 losing attempts to get one of these, but I think he's of the mental mindset now to be ready to be a champion.
Yeah, I think it's all about getting hot at the right time. That's what Joey Logano did last year. We've seen other people, Jimmy Johnson in 2016.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't, I don't think there's ever a thing of peaking too early, but Hamlin, I think he's peaking right at the right time. And obviously we have an off week this week, but then we go to Darlington and that's arguably his best track. So, spoiler alert, next week I'm going to pick Hamlin on the podcast to win Darlington. So, yeah, I mean, the 11 team's hitting on all eight cylinders right now. But now someone who isn't, I guess two drivers, you could argue three drivers that aren't. Stewart Haas Racing with Clint Bowyer, Daniel Suarez. You know, Daniel Suarez has gained 45 points or so in the past three or four races, but Clint Bowyer's lost that amount. And obviously, you know, had he not wrecked out of Michigan, he'd probably be in a pretty comfortable position right now in terms of the playoffs. But Neff, he finds himself 2 points out, and they finished 7th and 8th this past week, with Bowyer 7th, Suarez 8th. Bowyer's spin ultimately, you know, right before the end of stage two, led to Suarez getting 9 stage points, which put him ahead of Bowyer in points. So, and then you got Jimmy Johnson, who I want to throw in here. Obviously, doesn't run for Stewart Haas, but you said he's racing like a bag of hammers right now, or running like a bag of hammers. They can't do anything right. I mean, how do you see this playoff turning out? Because Newman looks like he's in a pretty good spot, but anything can happen. We got Darlington Indy coming up, so you know. What do you see? What are you foreseeing going in terms of the playoffs?
I mean, I've been vocal about it all along that I think the whole Cinderella story thing is going to come down at Indy with Jimmy Johnson winning the race to make the playoffs. And
they just don't have speed, right now, though.
It doesn't look that way, but I'm still hanging my hat on that one. That it's all going to come together, and at Indy, he's going to win the race, and that's going to put him into the playoffs. Which basically means Suarez and Bowyer will both be out. And that'll be all the raging talk. And you talk about guys that are shooting themselves in the foot. How about Almirola? He's been worse than the other two. I mean, he has torn up cars in like the last four races, I think. From memory, I didn't look it up, but he's been shooting himself in the foot quite a bit of late.
And
so, yeah,
it's
Stewart Haas in general, it's definitely not 2018. Things have been way more of a struggle this year.
Yeah, and for Almirola, I mean, it's been definitely the past two races where he thought he was clear. And on Hemrick last week in Michigan, nowhere near clear. And then he was, who was it this week? It was a lap car. Can't remember which one. But he thought he was also clear and wasn't. So, yeah, I mean, they are shooting themselves in the foot, but he's had a better regular season statistically than them because he's in a better position points-wise, gained more stage points. And then, you know, you got Newman who's plus 14. So that's not comfortable, but he can have maybe a little slip-up. And then you got Suarez who's 2 points above Bowyer. That's obviously not, you know, very comfortable at all. And then you got Johnson, who's 26 points back. I think Johnson's in a must-win now. I think he's got to win one of the last two. And, you know, good for him. They're two of his better tracks. But over the course of the career, Jimmy hasn't had many bad tracks. And he's ran, to be honest, pretty bad the past year and a half. So, if not longer. I mean, honestly, 2.5 years. So, I personally don't think Jimmy's going to get in. I don't see him winning Darlington or Indy. Because they just don't have the speed. I think Bowyer's going to get in over Suarez. I do think Newman's going to get in. And I think Bowyer gets in over Suarez. They'll turn their stuff around in the last two races.
I feel like Bowyer's going to shoot himself in the foot again at Darlington and be in a must-win situation at Indy, and I don't picture him winning at Indy.
That could be the case. I mean, he's had a terrible, terrible summer. He went from 9th or 10th in points down to 17th. So, I mean, even this past week, he made a mistake in traffic and got turned by Quinn Huff. And that's what led to Suarez getting points.
And again, I wouldn't say he got turned by Quinn Huff. I would say he turned himself off of Quinn Huff's nose.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because Huff was holding his line. There was nowhere else for him to go, and Bowyer came down across his nose.
That's fair.
So you would hope that Huff might have been able to hit the brakes there and avoid it, but it's Bristol, and you hit your brakes there, you're losing four spots. I mean, you can't be driving defensively at Bristol. So I didn't think Huff did anything wrong. I thought Clint tried to get to the bottom too quickly without being cleared, and it bit him. So, I just feel like this is going to be a lost season for Bowyer, sadly.
And it could ultimately cost him his ride. Maybe if he does make the playoffs, even it costs him a ride.
In the 14. Ooh. I don't think it happens, but that would be awesome.
Anything else on the Bristol Cup race, or you want to move to Xfinity?
You were there. What happened with Dylan?
Austin Dylan? On
the broadcast, he went behind the wall, and they never showed him until very late in the race. I saw him get passed. But they never talked about when he came back out or what they had to fix on his car.
Austin Dillon, you're talking about?
Yeah.
So he cut down that tire, obviously, and that's what got Jimmy Johnson all torn up there right at the beginning of the race. Lap 81 it happened. And Hamlin also got involved in that one as the leader. But, man, you want to talk about drivers that can't catch a break? Austin Dillon's right at the top of that list. They've had speed this year, which, as you know, over the past couple of years, it's been kind of a rarity for Richard Childress Racing, but they just can't do anything with that speed. He's had worse luck, in my opinion, this year than Hemric, and Hemric was the one at the beginning of the year that was having the fans sending good luck charms. But I talked to Dylan about this at the breakouts on Friday after qualifying, and he was pretty honest. He's like, you know, we had the speed. He said it's the most frustrating year of his career because he doesn't know what he's doing wrong, and you know, a lot of it's out of his own control. And that's the most frustrating part. It's just whether they have a mechanical failure, a tire like this week, blow and ultimately cost Jimmy Johnson points too, which, you know, you don't ever want that. You don't want to be the reason that another driver also has a bad day. So to answer your question, I think the damage was just too much. And man, he was Mike Massey and I were sitting next to each other. Oh man. Get us together. We'll crack some jokes, right? So we're in the press box, and we see him going around, and he just keeps going around and around and around on pit road, and it's like, what's he doing? And then they finally brought him in. So I'm guessing they're just the damage was too much. So yeah, I ended up finishing 34th, 113 laps down. Not what he wanted, obviously, but same thing with Stenhouse. I mean, Stenhouse had that issue with Blaney. And Stenhouse ended up finishing 109 laps down in 33rd. So, yeah, I think it's just too much damage.
Gotcha. I didn't know what they changed to bring him back out and have him get back on track. So I didn't know if he like pinned an A-arm or tie rod end or what the deal was.
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact part, but it had to have been something suspension-wise.
Gotcha.
All right, let's move on to the Xfinity race because this race is pretty good too. It seemed like nobody wanted to win this race, Neff, because
I feel like Tyler Reddick wanted to win it really bad.
Okay, everyone besides him. Because, so Reddick, you know, he couldn't even qualify. His car failed inspection four times, didn't get to make a qualifying lap, started last, and then as soon as the race started, had to make a trip down pit road, and then he ultimately was a lap down. Now, he was saved by a lap 8 caution, which put him back on lead lap. And then by the end of stage one, he was battling for the stage win with Allgaier. They both spun out. Well, Reddick spun out. Allgaier had a hell of a save. But Brandon Jones got by for the stage win. That was really good short track racing. And then just throughout the race, you had Kyle Busch, you know, dominating, then blowing up with five laps to go in stage two, you know, but still running and winning the stage, which was pretty cool. And then you had the early crash with Joey Logano, Eric Jones, Christopher Bell, and Cole Custer. That took out four big names right there. So, yeah, I mean, this race was wide open, and ultimately, man, Justin Allgaier can't buy luck this year.
Nope. It seems like whatever he does and tries to do it as right as he can, it just something freaky happens. And we saw it in the spring race at Bristol. I mean, should have won that race easily and had a weird park failure take him out of it. And it's happened at least half a dozen times this year. I mean, they have just been so snake-bitten. But, I mean, he's still in some of the best equipment in the sport, and he's still one of the best drivers in the sport. And ironically, I forget who it was I was talking to that said, just looking at him, he is in about the best shape he's ever been in.
Yep.
That he just is leaner and just has really taken care of himself. And that's something that, I mean, we've seen it, and I don't know if that comes from being around Hendrick Motorsports and being exposed to Jimmy Johnson as much as he is, but it definitely doesn't hurt his efforts. But man, he just, one of these races, something's got to go right for him to get him into the playoffs, and we're about out of time.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to make it regardless, but on points. But he should have about five victories this year, probably four or five, and both at Bristol. He's led 269 of the 600 laps at Bristol this year. Had nothing to show for it because the right front hub burned up in the spring race, which ironically was the same thing that happened to Jeb Burton, his teammate, this past weekend. You know, he had a hub burn up, and so he finished way back in the pack. But this one really stung for Allgaier. I've never, and you know, we talk about nice guys. This guy's like the nicest guy probably in the world, not just NASCAR. And he was so bummed after this race, and it was so hard to ask him questions because, you know, he was just irritated and frustrated, and he was wearing his emotions on his sleeve, and you could definitely tell that, which I feel like he does a really good job of kind of hiding that sometimes. But he's a fiery guy when he wants to be, as we saw with Chastain a couple weeks ago at Watkins Glen. Ultimately finishes eighth, two laps down. That's how crazy this race was, two laps down and eighth. So, you know, not the end of the world, but you want to see him, and he wants to, obviously, get into victory lane because he won five times last year, hasn't won yet this year. I do think a victory's coming, but Bristol is probably their best shot.
Yep, I agree. I mean, I thought that this was the one, but oh well.
Yeah, and then Reddick.
Things happen.
Reddick.
But it's funny you mentioned the post-race, and I agree, it's your job, and you got to try and get stuff out of them, and sometimes it's really painful. It reminds me of our buddy Doug Turnbull, and one of the very first times he was ever on pit road for a PRN radio broadcast was at Atlanta, and Martin Truex dominated the race, dominated it. And on the last restart, he was in second, so he had to restart on the outside, and this was back before he had really won. You know, and everybody was like, he keeps losing these races. And this was just another one of those nights where they had the restart, the inside lane goes, and Truex ends up like fourth. And I was right at his car when the cars all came down pit lane, and he got out. And you could see the steam rising off his head. He was so mad. And I see Doug standing there, and TV gets like one answer out of Truex. He's just not talking. And PRN throws it to Doug, and he goes up to try to ask him questions, and Truex is just not in the mood, and giving him like one-word answers, and you could tell that in Doug's ear, PRN is trying to get him to freaking keep asking him questions, and I'm just standing there going, let this poor kid go, man, because it was just painful to have to watch, but it's one of those deals that we love about our sport, is when somebody is in that exact moment, and you get the truest emotions of that moment. And again, to go back to Matty D, I mean, seeing his eyes well up and hearing his voice cracking at the end of the night. I mean, that's what we want. And that's what endears these guys to us. So I know Justin's going to get there, and it would be interesting, if not ironic, to have him be the guy that wins the Xfinity title without a win in the series. That'd be pretty awesome.
That would be crazy. But yeah, I don't know what was going on TV-wise the other night, but man, they'd have been standing with Allgaier for like 5 minutes. They interviewed Reddick on the front stretch, I believe.
I don't know. And that's even worse. Yeah. And I've been in that situation before too, where the guy is pissed off and really doesn't want to talk to you, and you're standing there next to him, and they're taking forever to throw down to you. And you're just like, the guy's just sitting there getting madder and madder because you're making him stand there, and he doesn't want to be standing there.
Right.
That doesn't help the interview at all.
No, not at all. But, you know, his bad luck led to, and these guys ran well all night. You know, Jeremy Clements finished fourth, his first top five since Road America 2 years ago when he won. Greg Alding, sixth. Timmy Hill, seventh. This was his best run on, it ties his best career run, but then his best run on a non-super speedway race. And then Landon Castle, last week's podcast guest, in 10th for JD Motorsports. Even Brandon Brown, 12th, and Shane Lee, 13th. They all had good runs. Clemens specifically, he's like, we're going to kick their ass next week at Road America. And he says that, you know, kind of jokingly, but not really, because he won there 2 years ago. So, hey, man, I was really impressed with him. And out of all the drivers, I'm kind of going off cusp here, but if out of all the drivers that haven't had a good shot in, like, big-time equipment, he's near the top of the list that I'd like to see have an opportunity.
Yep, I agree. I mean, he again, that when they won that Elkhart Lake race, that chassis was like 8 years old.
Yep.
I mean, that thing was junk, and they went out there and outran everybody. And I mean, you're just like, it's a Chastain thing. You wonder if they'd have thrown him in a 42 for a race or two, what he would have done. But again, it's one of those guys doing it the old school way, and I don't know how long they have in this sport, guys doing it the old school way, or is this sport going to make a change and everybody's going to go to the old school way? We'll find out, but I hope he stays around for a long time, because we need those guys and those stories every once in a while.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, and I know I go off tangent on these things sometimes, but it's kind of like the NCAA tournament. We like to see a Cinderella story once in a while, but when they get to the Final Four, we really want the Blue Bloods. we don't, you know, they talk a big game about having, you know, and Gonzaga's a big name now, but back in the day when they were first coming around, they didn't really want Gonzaga to make the Final Four because it didn't pull the numbers that the Blue Bloods do.
Right.
And so, yeah, it'd be cool to see Jeremy Clements in the Final Four for Xfinity, but in reality, that's not what the majority of the sport wants and what the TV numbers want. So, again, I would love to see it. I think it'd be amazing to see all underdogs and have all the big names get, you know, have trouble and get knocked out, and have your champion come down to four guys, you know, all of them that have like one win because they won on a super speedway or on a strategy call or something in a rain shortened race, and somehow managed to make their way through the playoffs, and all four of them are guys that are sitting 15th to 20th in points. I think it'd be amazing. But the sport and the TV ratings and the things that make money for the sport, they don't want to see those Cinderella stories in the Final Four.
Yeah, I think the closest thing we've seen since this format, Newman's not an underdog story, but he never won.
When he finished second at Homestead without having a win, that could have been, and I still would love to see that happen in this whole win and you're in thing.
That would be interesting. I think at the Xfinity level, like, the biggest underdog that's been close to the Final Four is maybe Blake Koch, and that was the first year that him and Lee Filter and Colleague Racing were together in 2016. He missed the Final Four by like 7 points. So, hey, maybe we'll get that one of these days. But Neff, I want to talk about the truck race a little bit, just a little bit, because it was a bit of a shit show, as we talked about off air. Brett Moffitt won. There was, 12 cautions for 73 laps, so almost half the race again was ran under caution. Ross Chastain was pretty outspoken about that after the race, how they need to, NASCAR needs to, you know, kind of clean up the track. We talked about this a couple weeks ago after Eldora, how there's so many long cautions. Now this one, you know, there's a lot of just, I don't know, dumb racing, I thought. I didn't see a whole ton of the race, even though I was there. I was working on some other stuff that, you know, the Bailey Curry news that we broke. But you had Natalie Decker get wrecked under caution after spinning out by a wrecker. Her spotter being like, I'm done. That was awesome. You just don't hear stuff like that anymore. But in all seriousness, you know, Moffitt got the win, and he's moving into the round of six.
Yeah, he's a champion, and he got it done at the end of the race when it was time to get it done. And I'm with you. I got lambasted on social media because so many people thought that was a great race, and I just didn't understand it at all. I'm like, but then again, I used to hate Old Bristol back in the day of, I mean, the, what is this, the 20th anniversary of the Labonte wreck.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm as big a Dale Earnhardt fan as there was, and I thought he should have been black flagged. They never should have let him have that win. but they did, because that's back in the day, they didn't take him away. But it just, God, it was terrible. I mean, there was no rhythm to it. And again, I'm with you. I didn't get to see the whole race because I was working at a car show this weekend, so I only got to see the last 65 laps. But it was like root canal. I mean, there was one or two laps and then a caution. And you're just like, can we ever get this thing going? And it never just really had a flow. And yeah, it was, I don't know, that's not what I want to see out of my short track racing. It's different if you're at South Boston on a Saturday night than at the national level. But these guys are good enough at the national level that you shouldn't have to wreck people to pass them. And there was just way too many unnecessary incidents in the truck race. And that was not a highlight. It was still fun to watch, but it was not what I want to see. And I was glad. I was very worried that Xfinity and Cup would be the same. And it was really ironic that we got three different races this weekend, because trucks were nailed to the bottom, Xfinity was pretty much nailed to the top, and Cup was all over the place. And so you kind of got all three versions of Bristol this weekend that we've seen over the last decade.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, if moving along here, we do have a couple, I guess, emotional topics to talk about. First, I want to talk about less emotional. We mentioned earlier in the show, but David Ragan retiring from full-time competition. He announced it last Wednesday, I believe it was, you know, that he's stepping away from the 38 in front row after the season. Obviously, he's most known for either the Daytona win or probably the Talladega win when him and David Gilliland teamed up to get to the front on the final lap for front row, giving it a 1-2 finish. I've always thought he's been a pretty solid race car driver. I don't think he got the right opportunity necessarily. He did have some, you know, a few rides with Gibbs in 2015 when Kyle was recovering from his broken leg. But other than that, he ran for Michael Waltrip Racing the rest of that year. Didn't do a ton there, but, you know, neither did really Clint Bowyer. So, what's your take on this? And, you know, he's only 33 years old. So, over the past few years, we have seen, you know, young drivers step away, like Carl Edwards, who was, what, 35. And it just seems to kind of be a trend. Casey Kane, which ultimately he was forced to after the fact that he announced it. But what's your take on this?
I mean, it's one of those deals where you've done it for a while and you get to that age, and it's more of your kids get to that age.
Right.
And your kids get to that age where they're starting to do things more than taking their first steps or riding in their power wheels. They're now starting to play baseball, play basketball, do gymnastics, cheerleading, whatever it might be. And you miss some of that. And as soon as you start missing some of that, you realize that you don't want to miss any more of it. And that's one of the things that I take away a lot from the Dale Jr. podcast, and watching Dale Jr. Download. He talks about that a lot, of not seeing much of his dad and his dad not being around, and how they would go, you know, they go race at Myrtle Beach, and his dad's never saw him race down there. And you just kind of try. And that honestly has always surprised me, because of guys that had the means back then, Dale Sr. had the means to go from wherever, Darlington over to Myrtle Beach. He could jump on a helicopter and be there like that and catch a race, or could have flown from someplace to see Junior race and didn't. But I have felt for a while that obviously is a point that that resonates with Junior, and why I think he's going to be really involved with Isla as she grows up. But I think that's where David is right now. And I don't know, but that's just the feeling I get because of the fact that it was mentioned. You know, he says, I want to spend more time with my kids. And I feel like that's just, you're at that point where you know you're not going to get a top tier ride. So you're in front row, or you're in, you know, go fast or whatever. And you're old enough that you're not going to get a Hendrick ride. You're not going to get a Joe Gibbs ride. So you can continue doing this and make a living, but you've made enough of a living now that you're financially set that you don't need to do this. And you can go be a part of your kids' lives as they start to establish their life and their passions. And I've, you know, it's anytime you give up on your dream is hard. And I'm sure it took a lot of soul searching for David, but in the end, I think it's just a matter of he feels like he's done what he could do in a sport, and now he can be a part of his kids establishing what they want to do.
Yeah, I think you stated that perfectly. It is interesting to see how they've, you know, the trend's been to retire younger, for the most part over the past handful of years or so, but. Yeah, he was very outspoken this week. They had a press conference saying how he wants to be there for his kids. And that's, you know, being a dad's number one in his life over being a race car driver. And he said to be, you know, competitive in the Cup Series or in NASCAR in general, you got to be fully committed, obviously. And that takes away from family life. So he's making the decision of family over racing, and you have to commend him for that almost. So kudos to David Reagan. It's been a pretty good career, only the two wins, but hey, that's two more wins than a lot of people can say, because not many people, if you look at it in the grand scheme of things, have won at the Cup level. So he had a great year in 2008 right out of the box, you know, rookie 2007, had a great year in 2008 and 14 top 10s and just missed the playoffs. And he was kind of at Roush when it was starting to go downward, and then he obviously won in 2011, had a decent year that year, and then since then, it's just been, you know, he went to front row, got the win, and then he subbed for Kyle Busch, like I said. And the past few years has been, you know, not very good. But, hey, family's number one for anybody. So, kudos to David Reagan. Now, Neff, next one's pretty emotional, I feel like, because, you know, Dale Earnhardt Jr. Obviously went to he's going to broadcast the race at Bristol over the weekend. On Thursday, his private plane that he was on with his wife, his daughter, and his dog, obviously the two pilots, went down. Really scary when I saw it on Twitter at first. Obviously, it turned out to be even, you know, more gnarly and scary after I saw the plane. I actually went and saw it Friday. Saw the fencing wrapped around the fuselages of the plane and then just the body of it. And, you know, very, very happy and very fortunate that he and his family are right. They had a few bumps and bruises. On the Dale Jr. download this week, he came out with a statement saying, you know, he was appreciative of all the fans' responses and all the media and, you know, people in NASCAR's response. It's gotten him through this. It's been a tough time, but, you know, they can't really say anything because it's an ongoing investigation on what happened with the plane. Neff, when I saw this in person, it almost made me sick to my stomach. I put a tweet out that said that because it was right on the highway, and this just could have been so, so bad. It could have ended so bad, and thankfully it didn't.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that he got really lucky. And everything that I've read about it made it sound like the fencing could have really changed things.
Yeah.
Because the way it wrapped around the plane, it came up about 3 feet short of getting to the door. And if it had gotten to the door, they probably would not have been able to open the door, and they probably wouldn't have gotten out. And I know, having been around in the 90s when we lost Davey, and we lost Allen, and We lost Brian Kirchhoff, which that name will mean nothing to anybody that's listening to this podcast. But he was the Bassmaster Classic champion, and he was from the Federation. And the Federation is like your local guys. And at the Classic, there's five local guys that work their way up through the local ranks and get a shot to compete with the pros. Well, he actually won the Bassmaster Classic. First guy to ever come through the local ranks and do that. And around the same time, Stevie Ray Vaughan, you know, all these people died in these plane crashes and helicopter crashes, and Kirchhoff was the same way. But you never get over that kind of a shock, because it's, you know, when somebody's older and passed away and you expect it or you're anticipating it, yes, it's sad. You know, David Pearson's passing was really sad, but we all knew he wasn't doing well. But when you take somebody who's young and vibrant and early in their life as a parent and shortly removed from the series, and you were on the verge of losing them, it affects everybody. And I remember when Dale Sr. died, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. I mean, it emotionally affected me a lot. And I was coming home from work and listening to a sports talk show, and they were talking to a guy, and he said his son was sitting in his number 3 pedal car in his living room with all his 3 garb on, and they announced that Dale had passed, and the guy looked at his son, looked at him, and said, "Who do I root for now, Daddy?" And I was driving down a road, and I literally had to like pull over and bawl, because it messed me up. And so that's where we are with this thing. It always blows me away that you hear these news reports about something. You know, a plane goes off the end of a runway or a bus skids off a road, and they talk about cuts and bruises or something like that. And you have a visual in your mind of, oh, it like bumped into a pole and, you know, somebody got a scratch on their elbow. And then you see videos and you see pictures and you start seeing the injuries, and these people have bruises like cover their whole body, and you're like, holy crap, that was way more than you thought. And that's where I was with this. The initial reports were, you know, his plane skidded off the runway, everybody got off okay. And so you're having this vision of, yeah, it slid off the end of the runway and everybody just kind of walked out, and that was that. And they took him to the hospital just to get checked out. And then you start seeing videos and hearing reports of how the plane was on fire before it stopped, and they were running out of the plane, and Junior collapsed, and the dog came sprinting out, and the pilots barely got out before the flames engulfed the door. And it all gets really real. And so that's where I'm super happy that everybody got out okay and nobody had any real big deals. I know I've heard all sorts of people saying he should quit flying, and that's just silly. I mean, it's almost like getting struck by lightning. You know, if you get struck by lightning once, you're probably pretty good for the rest of your life, because it's not a whole lot of people that get struck more than once. So if you were in one plane crash, unless you're Jack Roush, you're probably pretty good. So I'm glad that it turned out well, and I know that it's changed. Now, Junior already had a great perspective on family to begin with, but I promise you it's even more deeply rooted now that he's been through this.
Yeah, you said that, again, perfectly. Kind of emotional now, because it is a real situation. Like, we don't think about, and you know, NASCAR drivers have, most of them, have the luxury of flying private aviation. And Brad Keselowski went into this in depth on Friday at Bristol, and you know, it is a luxury, but you never think of what if, like what could happen in everyday life. You don't get in a car and you're like, oh, I'm going to go in a car accident today. You just never know what's going to happen. Anything can happen. And so this was one of those instances. I had heard, just being there, you know, around the area, that the pilot actually did everything he could. And, you know, obviously it's a split, you know, we sit and talk about NASCAR being split second. Well, flying a plane is obviously very split second. So when you're landing, you know, I've never even thought about, you know, being a pilot. So I heard that he made the right decision and did what he could, you know, obviously went through the fence only because there was a highway right there, which was a major highway in Tennessee. and did what he could not to get in the highway. So, you know, he had ABC News, Fox News, CNN there, and it was obviously a huge story. And so thankful that everything turned out the way it did, and, you know, no one thankfully lost their lives or any, you know, even got seriously hurt at all. So, man, it got real. It got real, real fast in Tennessee, and I was not expecting that when I got there on Wednesday and for it to happen Thursday. It was just wild. Crazy, crazy day on Thursday with all the stuff happening, and that topped it for sure.
Most definitely. And it just goes to show you, every time you show up at the racetrack, it never really unfolds the way you think it's going to.
For sure. All right, now, if you got anything else to talk about before we get to predictions here, we got, you know, no cup race, but we got a pair of road courses for the Xfinity and Truck Series.
It's another one of those that I swear I had something else I wanted to talk about that has completely left me. Other than two thumbs up to my man, P2, Randall Burnett, the crew chief for Tyler Reddick. I know I've mentioned it before on a podcast. I used to work on Randy's late model back when he was racing, and it's pretty awesome that he has scored 4 wins this year with Tyler. I think those two are doing some great things. I haven't talked to him yet about them failing tech. I got to find out what in the wide world of sports was going on there. But it's pretty cool that they're definitely a favorite. They're probably not the favorite, but they're a favorite for this championship.
For sure, but he wasn't a favorite last year either, and he won it. Obviously, different team, but he can get around Homestead. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, I would not put it past him to win this year.
Oh, speaking of getting around Homestead, did you see the video?
Noah Gragson.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was wild.
Running the fence
with a camera.
That'll give you a perspective. If you haven't seen it, get on Twitter. Either pull up Noah Gragson or Kyle Larson, because Larson retweeted it. But they mounted a GoPro on the right side of Gragson's car, right rear, as he was testing at Homestead, and he ran the fence. And you sit there and watch that and imagine having to do that 300 times.
Yeah.
Without making a mistake.
For sure.
And it's, I mean, literally, it looks like, and I'm sure it's probably 4 to 6 inches, but it looks like he's an inch away from the wall all the way through both corners.
Right. Yeah, that's a cool video. I did think of something before we sign off, and I know we don't cover IndyCar a lot, so I want to keep this brief. We don't cover it on the podcast at least. But
that was the other thing I wanted to talk about. Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, I want to keep this brief, but Saturday night I drove from Bristol to Pocono. It was a long drive, but I was on the way home, just up 81 pretty much. So I wanted to check out IndyCar race because I've never been to one in person. And this, you know, Pocono's obviously not the best track for IndyCar over the past 5 years or so. Now, first lap accident for the second straight year, I believe, right? It happened on the first lap last year, too, in the same turn, tunnel turn. Just drivers, racing pretty aggressively. In retrospect, you know, all the blame was on Takuma Sato, but it looked like he just held his car straight, and it didn't look like he was the problem. It looked like Rossi actually came up on him. What's your take on this? Because, you know, obviously in a contract year, Pocono IndyCar is, and it doesn't look like they'll be back next year, but should IndyCar be racing at tracks like this? Because honestly, Pocono's a lot like Indianapolis.
If Dale Sr. were only still alive, tie the kerosene rags around your ankles so that the ants don't bite your candy ass. I know that I'm old school and I'm a grumpy old fart and I come from that time, but for God's sakes, it's auto racing, it's open wheels, it's open cockpits, there's danger. All these people freaking out about this, like, we got to get rid of all ovals, and it's just too dangerous. No, it's auto racing, and it's dangerous. And so many people have become so desensitized to this because NASCAR has become so safe, and the fact that there is no legitimate danger of death. I mean, death can still happen. We've seen that, and I go back to, and I don't know the gentleman's name, but there was a rookie doing a rookie test at Indy years ago. He was a Japanese driver, and he came into the short shoot in 1 and 2 and tank slapped the wall and rolled to a stop on a backstretch, and they got to the car, and he was dead. And he was doing like 150. I mean, he was nowhere near the limits of the car. And they, you know, they do an autopsy and they figure out that he had a genetic condition where there wasn't enough fluid around his brain, so his brain slammed against his skull and he died, and he never should have been in a race car. But I come from the old school days of the 60s, 70s, and 80s in Indianapolis where people were dying on a regular basis. And I don't want to get back to that. It was part of what made me a race fan was because these guys cheated death all the time. And yes, they don't do that anymore, and that has caused, you know, some of the allure of auto racing to go away for me. But at the same time, come on, people, it's racing. There is inherent danger, especially with open wheel cars. And the fact that they want to do away with all ovals because it's so dangerous. And I'm like, if you want it to be that safe, then everybody will do it. And I mean, I go back to the Ken Squire line, I think it's Squire, maybe a Kanamaki, of it is common men doing uncommon things. I don't want any Joe Blow to be able to go out there and race because they don't go fast enough and they don't drive close enough. It fired me up when I saw all this stuff on social media about this is crazy, this has got to change. What's got to change is going three wide into the tunnel turn on lap one. That was dumb. And the fact that you let drivers do dumb things because drivers are dumb, dumb things happen. And it wasn't the track's fault. Is there potential to change catch fence technology? Probably. I think it was Aaron Bearden tweeted out that we really haven't done anything to change catch fence technology other than when Weldon was killed. SMI changed, at least I think they changed their catch fence to put the poles on the outside instead of the inside, because that was ultimately what killed Weldon. When he hit the fence, the pole that holds the fence up was on the inside of the fence towards the track, and his head hit the pole, and that was what killed him. So I think they fixed that. But yeah, catch fence technology should probably be looked at a little bit because cars are going to get there. But I mean, my God, how many times do sprint cars get into catch fences all year long? And yes, we've had some guys die because of that. But again, it's auto racing, and it's why it's one of the three true sports in the world between that and bullfighting. You know, I mean, it's it's that danger, and it's what draws us to it. And if we're going to just eliminate danger, then we might as well eliminate auto racing, because it is what it is. I hate it for Pocono. I think they're getting a bad rap because guys do stupid things, and they don't deserve it.
So I'm going to cut in here. Yeah, I agree with you on most of what you said, for sure. Obviously, I don't want to get back to the 80s or 90s either, when, you know, a lot of drivers are dying, because we've advanced so much since then, as in IndyCar, NASCAR, whatever, technology in general. But you see the drivers, you know, even because you said Pocono gets a bad rap, and I totally agree. And, you know, Pocono is one of my two home tracks. Now, What I mean is, you know, it's the second closest track to me. But, you know, it's tough because Pocono, the IndyCar history of Pocono is very, very high. It was built for IndyCar back in the day. So, you know, one of the corners is modeled after Indy, and the other two are modeled after different tracks. But yeah, it's getting a terrible look over the past 5 years now, and not of its own doing. The incident with, you know, I want to speak carefully about this, but the incident with Justin Wilson could have happened anywhere, with just a piece of debris coming off. And then also, even Scott Dixon said this on Sunday after the race. All of these accidents could have happened anywhere, and ultimately they've happened all at Pocono, you know, unfortunately for the track. So it doesn't look like it's going to be back on the schedule. It seems like, and I don't think this is just a PR statement by the drivers. Scott Dixon said, you know, he hopes it's back. Will Power agreed with that, and obviously he's had a lot of success there over the past 5 years. And then Simon Pagenaud even, you know, kind of echoed their sentiments. So, yeah, it's a tough deal for Pocono, for sure. And they all want to see it back on the schedule. I like I said, I personally don't think we're going to, but who knows? Maybe I've been wrong before. Maybe I'll be wrong again. No.
Yeah, I mean, Pocono is one of my favorite tracks because of the fact that it forces you to make compromise and to learn to have the driver make a difference. And it's one of the few tracks left where that's the case. It's not a road course. And I'm with you. I've never been to a cup race at Pocono. That's one of the few that I haven't made to east of the Mississippi. But I went to IndyCar racing back there in the early 80s and have seen, you know, the legends of the sport run there. And it was, you know, it's a cool place. And, you know, we haven't had it in a little while, but there used to be like deer and rabbits and stuff running around on the track during the race. You know, it had that quirkiness to it. But it...
Yeah, it's in the middle of the woods for the most part.
I hate overreaction, and I feel like, yeah, it was a big wreck. We don't scream and holler to take Talladega and Daytona off the schedule every time there's a big one, and we get a lot of big ones. So I just think it's foolish to blame the track or the type of racing at the track when in all reality it's the drivers driving like idiots.
Fair. All right, now let's move on to pit predictions because we're getting long here. We got two road course races. The trucks will be in Canada for the only Canadian
with
race.
28 trucks.
Yeah, very small entry list compared to Bristol where they had 36 and had to send four home. And then we got an Xfinity race in Road America. Now, if we'll start with the trucks, they're both running on Sunday. Who you got?
All right, so the cheesy pick is Alex Tagliani.
Right.
Because he's in Kyle Busch 51 and he's a road race specialist. So I think that's who's actually going to win. But I'm going to make my true pick, Todd Gilliland.
Took my pick.
Me too. But I know I did.
He's going to get, I feel like he might get redemption this year because he should have won the.
I think he will too.
He should have won the race last year and was turned in the final corner by Noah Gragson and neither of them won the race. Since you're going with them, Ross Chastain's a favorite really anywhere we go, but he's self-admittedly, he doesn't like road course racing or doesn't feel he's good at it. I'll go Sauter. I picked him last week too, and that didn't happen, but he didn't win in Bristol. But I feel like he's got a breakthrough here eventually, and he has been a good road racer, so I'll go Sauter. Now, moving on to Xfinity, I feel like, you know, the Xfinity road courses are, they run at some of the most historical ones in the country, if not the world, with, you know, Watkins Glen, Road America, Mid-Ohio. Who you got? Because this is a pretty stacked field. You got Regan Smith in it, again, for Junior Motorsports. Matt DiBenedetto is in it for Joe Gibbs Racing. I feel like you might go with him. Who you got?
I was going to let you pick first since I got to pick first in truck.
All right, I'm going Matty D then. I think he's going to win. I feel like, you know, just like we said, Gillen get redemption. I feel like in, I guess, a little bit of a lesser form of redemption, this will be redemption for him from last week. He's a good road racer, as we've seen. He's got two top sixes this year in the cup level. He's going to have to battle the guys like Austin Cindric, and, you know, I think Regan Smith and Allgaier obviously will be good. But I say Matty D gets it done.
All right. I, again, think that Austin Cindric is probably going to get the win just because he's been so hot on road courses. But I'm going with an upset this weekend. Hala Fagrala in the 21, Kaz Grala, because he's a great road racer. He's spent a lot of time road racing of late, and I think he's going to be a little underrated. He's in Childress Racing with my buddy Justin Alexander on a box. So I think the 21 is going to get it done.
And don't overlook someone like Jeremy Clements.
Not at all.
You know, he won there 2 years ago, which, like we talked about earlier, probably should never have happened because the chassis was so old. You just don't see that in present-day NASCAR until 2 years ago. But he's got a new road course car that he's ran at Watkins Glen and Mid-Ohio, finished 11th in both of them, but has also scored stage points in both of them. So, and he's on a little bit of a hot streak here, you know, in terms of that team. So, look... he told me like, we're gonna kick their ass, so hey, hopefully maybe he'll back it up. Neff, any final thoughts before we get to Daniel Suarez?
No, not right now.
Got it. All right, Neff, now, like I just mentioned, kind of spoiled it, Daniel Suarez is on the podcast this week. Talked to him in Bristol, kind of talked to him about how he feels racing against his teammate Clint Bowyer for that final playoff position, and also his season, his first season with Stewart Haas Racing. We talked about him a lot on this podcast, Neff, but do you feel like he gets in the playoffs or no? And then how do you feel about his transition to SHR?
I feel like the transition to SHR has been pretty good. Anytime you go into a new environment, there's a learning curve. And, you know, it may have taken him a little longer than it took Truex at JGR, but I feel like they've been getting better as the season has progressed. I've always thought Daniel was a really good driver, and especially because he is very open to constructive criticism and help from his teammates. And I always enjoyed that. Whenever I saw him at the track doing trucks or doing Xfinity, he often would get Kyle Busch to jump in his car and go out and take a couple laps just to make sure that what he thought he was feeling was what he was feeling and was willing to listen to other people to be a better driver. And I especially like the fact that just historically looking at his career in trucks and Xfinity, when he would go back to a track, he would get better. It was very rare that they went to a track and without a mechanical failure did worse than the previous time they'd been there. And I think that speaks volumes about his intuition and his learning as a driver. So I think he's got a bright future in front of him. I think it's pretty cool that he basically came to America not knowing how to speak English and has taught himself and really done well with it. You know, I mean, that's one of the things that drives me nuts when I see some of these baseball players that are from the Dominican Republic or from South America or whatever, that have been in the States for like 8 or 10 years and still don't speak a word of English. And I don't understand how you're immersed in our culture and you don't pick it up at least a little bit. So I've always respected Daniel for that he came here, immersed himself in our culture, and chased his dream and has realized it. And I know he gets a bad rap from some people because of the Harris tie-in. And again, people think he bought his ride, but I mean, he's a champion in the National Touring Series. You can never take that away from him. And I think he, again, will win races. I don't know if he'll win a championship at the Cup level. We'll see, but he's definitely going to win races down the road.
For sure. Now this is a fun conversation. So let's get to my interview with Daniel Suarez.
Now, right now you're racing right around the bubble there. How would you gauge the first season with Tour House Racing?
It's been okay. I feel like the team has been working very hard to try to make our race cars better. I feel like I've been there right there with the group, you know, adapting with the whole team and stuff like that. But I feel like we have done okay job. I can say that I have done an amazing job, but I haven't won races yet. But I feel like we're gonna get there. The team is getting better, and I feel like slowly we are getting close to reach our goals.
Obviously, when you join a new team, there's a lot of adjustments. What has been the biggest adjustment for you?
Well, there's a lot of little things. You know, I was very fortunate to come from a good organization and to land in another very good organization. So just to adapt a little bit to the way that my engineers work and my crew chief and the whole team, you know, meetings and stuff like that. It's a little bit different of a system, but it works very well. So we have fast race cars, and we always try to help each other to be better. And in the beginning of the year, we were not even close to where we really wanted to be. And I feel like right now we are not there yet, but we're much closer. So I feel pretty good about it, and hopefully we can keep moving in the right direction.
How long do you feel like it took you to fit in with Stuart House Racing? Was it instant, or did you have to work some chemistry and get to know the people at the shop?
I mean, it takes a little bit, but overall, you know, if you have good communication with your people and you get along well with them, that happens pretty quick. So I feel like we did a good job adapting quick. It's very hard to put a time into that, but we did a good job. And I feel like, you know, we keep getting even better, you know, knowing each other and trying to get better.
Prior to this year, what was your relationship with Kevin, Clint, and Eric?
Well, with Eric was very good. With Kevin and with Clint, he was just, you know, like most of the other drivers, just a good relationship in the racetrack. That was it. With Eric was a little bit more than that. But now already I can call them a friend, and we spent you know, quite a bit of time together talking about the cars. What do we need to do to be better and to keep improving our program.
I want to talk about Billy Scott for a minute. Obviously, first year working with him, how did that relationship evolve? And was there time you guys spent away from the track to kind of work on that personal and professional relationship?
You know, I feel like Bill and I actually, we got together very well because we had the same personality. He's one of those guys that he does today, what everything that he can, and he don't let things wait for tomorrow when he can do those things today. And I'm the same way. So he like to get things done, and he works very hard. He's very smart, and he's a very good leader. And I feel like our chemistry has been working extremely well. So I feel like we have a good future together. I feel like we're gonna win races together soon.
In general, because you had a crew chief change, obviously, at the end of last year. How long do you feel like it takes to gel with a crew chief? Forget SHR, just in general.
It takes some time because you need to know what the driver and the crew chief like. Mm-hmm. I have always said this, that it's kind of like a relationship. You have to know that person. You have to know what person like, what they don't like, and all those kind of things based on racing with the car. So it takes some time, and... That's something actually I struggled a lot in the last couple of years, that the consistency was pretty bad, always moving people around, and that's always, that's sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not. But the 41 team has had a lot of consistency in the people, and there is a lot of good people in there, and I'm very, very happy to be part of them.
Obviously, the regular season's winding down. What's the pressure like on the 41 team right now? Obviously, sitting just outside, going into Bristol.
I mean, there is a little bit of pressure, but nothing too crazy. We have to do our job and race, and try to do what we know how to do. We can control everything. We have to control what we can control. So. I think we're going to be fine. I think that if we keep doing our job, we should be in good shape.
Do you points race? I mean, obviously you want to win every race, but how does your mentality change having to point race? Or are you even looking to point race, obviously wanting to win?
No, I mean, I feel like actually the mentality does change. I feel like right now I'm not in the position to take big risks. Uh-huh. I cannot go out there and wreck. If I do that, that's going to be on me. I cannot do that. I cannot afford that. I can't do what the 48 and the 14 did last weekend. Because if I do that, I'm going to lose 30, 40 pounds, who knows? And I can't afford that. So I have to be smart about that. Just know what I have as a race car and try to maximize that. And I have already a good result. Obviously, I'm a driver. I like to win races. But I have to be smart as well. I have to take opportunities when I know the opportunity is clear. But if this opportunity... It's going to be 50-50, either finish top three or wrecking. I prefer to finish four, you know what I mean? So that's something that I have to be smart about. Obviously, if it's for the win, I'm going to do it. But I have to know where I'm at in the racetrack to know if it's worth the risk-reward.
Is it weird racing a teammate for one of the final two spots?
No, I think it's fun. I see him as another driver, obviously he's a friend, and we share a lot of information, but once we're in the racetrack, he's just one more driver.
You still share information even to this day, knowing that it's, two teams battling each other?
Of course, yeah, we share everything. And I try to help him, and I'm sure he tries to help me. Once we're in the racetrack, it's all about myself, and I'm sure that he thinks the same way. That's the way you have to race. I mean, to be in the Cup Series, you have to think about yourself. You have to be a little selfish once you're in the race car, in the racetrack for the race. But before that, I mean, we share plenty of information, and he knows everything that I'm doing. I know everything that he's doing, and that's the way it works.
A couple more for you, Daniel. Should you make the playoffs? The playoff tracks, it seems like they kind of favor you a little bit. Are you confident? Should you make it?
Yeah, I think we should be fine. I feel like the most important part is that the team is getting better. Mm-hmm. I feel like the team is much better now than 3-4 months ago. So I feel very good about that. Hopefully we can make it. Hopefully we can be in the party and have some good, solid runs once we're in it.
What are some of your goals going forward, regardless if you make the playoffs or not?
Just keep improving. Keep getting better. Hopefully, I feel like slowly we are getting to a point where we want to be. It's being consistent in the top 5, top 10. And once we are there, I feel like we can start thinking about winning races.
And I'll get you out of here on this one. Next week, go to Darlington, having a throwback scheme to your boss, Tony Stewart.
Yeah.
Overall, you like the paint scheme, and what's it like representing Tony?
He's very cool. Tony obviously has been somebody that has been great for the sport. He's a true racer, and he's been very helpful already for Stewart House Racing and for me to be here. And it will be extremely, extremely special to to have a strong result, and why not even a victory with that paint scheme.
Thanks for your time, Daniel.
Thank you.
All right, y'all. So there you have it. Fun conversation with Daniel Suarez there regarding his 2019 season, as well as racing his teammate Clint Bowyer for one of the final playoff positions. Always fun discussing racing with Neff, and this week was no different, as we, for the most part, were in agreement on the racing action this past weekend in Bristol, as well as most of the off-track news. That'll wrap up this week's show. As mentioned in the open, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast on Apple Podcasts. But until next week's show, where we review a pair of road course races for the Xfinity and Truck Series, we out.